This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll hear how one local government in Tehama County is faring operationally and financially during this pandemic. And we'll check in on a handful of cases of the virus at the Reading Veterans Home. We'll also head to Trinity County, one of two counties in the North State that still have zero confirmed cases of COVID-19. And if you have questions or comments, you can leave them on our message line 433-9216 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, April 16th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. The coronavirus pandemic has led to unprecedented job losses throughout the nation and fears of a sluggish economic recovery. For local governments, the pandemic means possible budget shortfalls going forward. NSPR's Andre Bayek recently spoke with Rick Crabtree, Red Bluff city manager, about how the crisis could affect the city's budget planning. The city has been physically closed to the public since the governor announced his stay-at-home order. Crabtree says operationally, it's been challenging.
We're all trying to do our job under some difficult and stressful circumstances on occasion. I'm proud of the way the city's employees have responded. We have always been on the brink of being in real trouble staffing-wise. If, for example, if we were to get one sick police officer, not only would that police officer go down himself and be unavailable to us, probably in isolation or quarantine, but all of the individuals that officer had come in contact with recently would also likely be quarantined, so that one illness could take out, you know, a third to half of the police department staff. But fortunately, that city employees have not contracted the virus.
It sounds like you could teeter into a situation in which there's not adequate staffing. How could you address such a problem like that?
Well, that is a possibility. Fortunately, it hasn't happened, but with this virus, it's a possibility. And these are people we're sending out into the public. Our first responders go out and have direct contact with the public so that they're in harm's way in terms of potential exposure. If we were to lose staff due to exposure to the virus, we would have to rely on our neighboring jurisdictions for help. For example, with law enforcement, we would turn to the Sheriff's Department for help. What could happen is the Sheriff's Department also has people who are exposed. So we all end up in a mutual aid circumstance, scrambling to help each other.
On top of the staffing concerns, it's my understanding that there's also financial concerns that this pandemic is bringing, both to local governments, state governments, and federally. What could a budget shortfall mean for city services?
Well, first line city services are always the initial budget priority. In other words, we fund police and fire first. But also important is our water department that supplies domestic water supply to the city, our sewer department that does wastewater collection and treatment. So we first make sure that we have enough to keep those functions running, maybe not at an optimum level, but at least at an acceptable level. And then the money that might be left over, we allocate to other departments and other expenses.
Looking forward, would you be able to take any cues from the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, as sort of a model to inform you about how things could end up going from here?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the frame of reference that many of us approach this crisis with. I can recall, I believe it was in 2009, when the city's balance carry forward reserve was less than six figures. Last year, it was seven figures. So things were much better just a few months ago.
It was recently announced that the Red Bluff Roundup Rodeo will not be taking place this year. It's a huge event for Tehama County and for Red Bluff. How does that event affect city revenues year to year? And how could its absence also affect the city going forward here?
Well, obviously, it is the biggest event, annual event in the city. It draws a lot of outside visitors. The city collects what we call transient occupancy tax, a tax on hotel rooms that are rented and sold during that event. We're confident we're going to be way off compared to last year. It's one of the revenue sources that hasn't dried up completely, but it's certainly a shadow of its former self.
What are some of the consequences that a significant budget shortfall could look like in Red Bluff? Perhaps furloughs or layoffs?
Furloughs and layoffs are certainly possible. I don't want to predict them without knowing our full budget picture, which I just simply do not know yet. We don't know how impacted our revenue accounts are going to be. We don't yet know what kind of help we're going to get from the state and federal government. So we're trying to remain optimistic. But, you know, you start cutting things that, you know, for example, we replace police cars every 4 years instead of every 3 years. We start making cuts like that. The city council next week will be deciding whether we open the public pool for the summer. So we've started looking for ways to save money right away. We're not waiting till next budget year to do that.
Is there anything I didn't ask you that you hoped to clarify or add about the city and the effects of the pandemic on the city?
I know people have been patient, and we continue to urge patience. The data shows that Tehama County residents have been largely compliant with the stay-at-home order. The trips away from home are way down from where they were a few months ago. So that's encouraging. We have only had one confirmed case in Tehama County thus far. Unfortunately, that individual passed away night before last. And it illustrates just how dangerous this disease or virus is. And it remains dangerous. So we want people to be patient, understand that the restrictions that are in place are to save lives, quite literally.
That was Rick Crabtree, city manager of Red Bluff, speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. Without immunity to this virus, all are vulnerable in this pandemic. But as we know, some are more vulnerable than others. That includes seniors. NSPR's Mark Albert recently checked in with Gary Moore, public information officer at the Reading Veterans Home, after a resident and four employees tested positive for the virus there. One of the first things Mark asked was when the first case was confirmed.
It was several weeks ago, and we got right on the case with our response team and how we were going to handle it, and following very close guidelines by the CDC and Shasta County Public Health. There's been a lot of things, like we now have a no visitors policy, and you know that seems to have dropped the traffic in and out of this building a lot. And when our residents, or actually anybody who comes in, they have their temperature checked. They have a series of questions that they are asked. They're being screened for a certain amount of things that are indicators for us. And then, of course, you know, if their temperature is 100.4 or above, then, we usually use that as a red flag and take action with that resident and make sure that they start isolating themselves.
How's the morale among residents?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. And overall, our veterans are reacting very well. They understand why we've taken these important steps. We've also supported our residents to connect directly with their families via FaceTime and Skype. We went out and the department provided us with a vast amount of iPads. So we can go to a resident and then we can call his daughter or a family member or something. And then they can go face to face. We had one of our residents that had his daughter on the line the other day, and she says, you know, at one time, Pa, you sang "You Are My Sunshine" to me, and he sang it word for word, didn't miss a beat. And I thought she was going to bust out in tears. I mean, her whole world came to life over that screen. And it was just a wonderful moment. You know, we've deployed 50 iPads across our homes to facilitate being able to do stuff like that. Six of those iPads are in the Reading home. And we know, I mean, we see it every single day. Our healthcare workers are the best ever. I mean, the people that are on the front lines of this thing, they are the new healthcare heroes in my book.
What is it like, or how difficult is it for people who are used to being able to clock out, you know, at the end of the day to know that they have to take extra care and avoid people even more to take care of themselves and also to protect the health of their clients during the day?
You're absolutely right about that. You know, one thing that's really important is we now have a policy that everybody wears a mask. And it's not because they're contaminated or, you know, but they may cross paths with somebody is contaminated. But we don't have the masks on our face because of others. We have the masks on our face to protect ourselves. If you think about it, how many times do you think you touch your face in a day? There's quite a few. And the greatest population of bacteria is around your mouth, eyes, mucous membranes, ears, things like that. So the masks that we are wearing are for our own protection, and they're so we keep our hands off of our face.
I imagine some combat veterans, you house all sorts of veterans, but combat veterans have faced moments of panic. But this is really a slow-moving crisis, and to maintain that kind of vigilance over months, and for many people, their service was many decades ago. How are people in the home reacting?
I will tell you, every resident in this home is very happy right now. I mean, I have my door closed because I got a couple of guys shooting pool right outside my door. But they've reacted very well. Whereas our regular activities, we have a very intense activities calendar and staff that manages that whole thing. So any public outings have all been canceled. So we're not taking them out. And right now, it's a little bit of an adjustment for them. I mean, they can go out if they want to, but when they come back, we'll do the same, you know, a screening process that we do on every employee when they walk in the door every morning. That's just all protocols for us. Our veterans, they're reacting very well. They understand why have taken these important steps, and they get it. You know, and I get the full spectrum. Some guy goes, you know, I'm got kind of cabin fever. I can't go out. But they can go out, and they've got little courtyards that they can go out to, and they can go out, you know, most places in the home. They can go up to the front of the building and get their mail, and they can go up into the general store and purchase things. But they are staying pretty much close to their own neighborhood, and that hasn't been very much of a problem. I mean, I asked one of our guys when this thing first started, I said, you know, how's this going to affect you? Are you going to be all right with the adjustment? He says, hey, I've had bullets and bombs coming at me. I ain't afraid of no virus. Which, you know, that said a lot to me, meant a lot to me, because if you think about it, some of these residents, we're on the front lines of war, and we are on the front lines as healthcare professionals, on the front lines against a silent opponent. Nobody knows the date. Nobody knows when it's going to end. But I will tell you, we have plenty of supplies. We have plenty of masks. We have plenty of gowns. We have plenty of gloves. All eight of our homes in the state have plenty of supplies, and we're ready at a moment's notice to get more if we need them. So things are going well. All of our precautionary measures are in place. We're really proud of them, and the CDC is really proud of them as well. They took a look at what we were doing, and you know, they had made the comment that, man, what exactly what you guys are doing looks like the playbook that we want people to follow.
That was Gary Moore, Public Information Officer at the Reading Veterans Home, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. You're listening to special coverage of the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. At this point, there are few counties in California without a confirmed case of COVID-19. As of April 16th, Trinity County was one of them. NSPR's Andre Bayek recently spoke with Marcy Jo Kudzel, Public Health Nursing Director for Trinity County, about what zero confirmed cases can tell officials about the spread of the virus, as well as the county's main concerns as it addresses the crisis. One of the first things he asked was what a possible surge could look like for the area.
That's hard to determine, primarily because the modeling tools that they're using, the systems that they're using to model, haven't been really, really good at drilling down at a local level and kind of, you know, identifying in a realistic way what surge might look like. And you can imagine in Trinity County, being a rural frontier community with one critical access hospital, that's going to look very different than, say, San Francisco that has multiple larger hospitals and more people. So essentially, the idea is the way we've approached this, and I've been doing this for a long time, the thing that works initially the best and that's the most important is the non-pharmaceutical interventions. So really very quickly putting in place aggressive strategies such as sheltering in place, stay-at-home orders, limiting large gatherings or no large gatherings, closing the schools. These are very aggressive policies, but they're very important because what they do is they buy us time. They buy us critical time to be able to put in place not only response strategies if we do indeed have community spread, but also they allow other areas of the country and in California to hit their peak. If we can put off having one case in Trinity County for as long as possible and others around us hit their peak, more resources become available. So we're trying to allow time for the science to catch up, to provide us with the ability, such as broader testing and treatment modalities that we can utilize that will help reduce the burden on healthcare systems.
You bring up a really important point, and that's that as of April 15th, Trinity County has zero confirmed cases of COVID-19. What does that number zero tell you about how the virus may be acting in your community?
That's a really good question. You know, here's what it tells us in a nutshell. It tells us that of those we've tested, none of them are positive at that moment, in that moment in time when they were tested. That's really all it tells us, because until we, and it's twofold really. So on the one hand, those that we are testing are negative. So that tells us a little bit about, okay, our aggressive strategies are working. We don't have broad community spread, right? So the one assumption is if we had broad community spread, we would know it. It's not like we would miss someone that was positive in that circumstance. But the other side of that is that until we have more testing available, there may very well be COVID in the county and we don't know it because we're not broadly testing. So it's kind of that double-sided coin.
Speaking to testing has been a challenge across the country. I'm wondering how Trinity County is faring when it comes to its capacity to test people for COVID-19.
Yeah, we're really in the same struggle that everyone else is. Testing is vital, not just the supplies needed to collect the specimen, but the ability to develop a testing system that has a high throughput. Coronavirus is not going away. This is going to be here for a while. So in looking at a longer term, both in the immediate, right, the acute phase right now of really identifying and doing contact investigation and then isolating people so that it doesn't broaden community spread, then you look at, okay, so into the future, in the absence of a vaccine, what does that look like? And as you know, it's been in the news, serology testing. There's a number of tests that will be beneficial in the future to help us both respond right now and in the future. You know, it's very challenging without having broad testing. It can be very challenging.
It sounds like testing may be the main bottleneck here to getting a better understanding of the virus.
Absolutely. Every expert, before we can start to begin to relax some of these non-pharmaceutical social distancing policies, we must have broader testing. Governor Newsom, I'm sure you heard in his press conference, talked about 6 indicators for modifying stay-at-home orders. And the very first one was about the ability to monitor and protect communities through testing.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about this pandemic that you want to clarify or perhaps add?
You know, the one thing I reiterate over and over again to our public that, number one, I'm so thankful for our population's sacrifices that they're making here in Trinity County, and that's not lost on us. The other is this is unprecedented. In the 20 years I've been doing public health and emergency medicine, another 10 years on top of that, we always prepared for things like this. I honestly did not think I would see it in my lifetime. And so we were as ready in Trinity County as we could be. And I'm just so proud of our administration, our public health team, our Health and Human Services team, our Office of Emergency Services team, and our state partners and regional partners, that we are responding in a way that's going to save people's lives.
That was Public Health Nursing Director for Trinity County, Marcy Jo Kudzel, speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. This pandemic has changed all of our normal in-person interactions. How we work, how we get therapy, how we hang out. Now we do it all remotely. And as you know, that's true for education too. NSPR's Mark Albert recently talked to Ann Nicoli, the program director at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, to find out how older adults, who are often labeled as being more tech-phobic, are handling the sudden jump to online learning from a lifetime of classroom learning experience.
You know, that's what we faced in early March. I think I panicked for about 5 seconds until I realized I couldn't afford to waste any more time. And we just dove in. And I think you're right. I think there's sort of a stereotype that older adults are maybe less inclined to pursue technology. But thank goodness that hasn't been the case. I think we've all jumped into this feet first together. And I'll tell you, within a week, we went from never having had an online class to having a dozen online classes on our website. And that was a fully team effort, thanks to our member volunteers.
Was it very difficult for you and the instructors that work for you to transfer things to an online setting if they'd never done that sort of thing before?
It was super hard. Fortunately, we suspended our classes. Ollie suspended its classes about a week before the university did. And that gave me the opportunity to be with my other colleagues from regional and continuing education, namely Jeff Lane and Melissa McGowan, who gave me a crash course in creating online classes. I was able to take that information and run with it. We used Zoom technology is what we're using, Zoom video conferencing technology. And fortunately, that company has great resources, tutorials and other lesson plans. We just split those up and started recording classes online. And now we're doing live classes as well.
What's been the feedback? I imagine that a lot of people who sign up to take classes are also yearning for the social connection of being in the same room. And, you know, I imagine that that's something that they're not getting these last few weeks.
Mark, you're exactly right, Mark. Our members were a little anxious about the loss of structure that our in-person classes provide. We relied a lot in the beginning on email, communicating our intentions, asking everyone to take a deep breath with us and be patient, that we were trying everything we could, pulling out all the stops, as they say, to continue delivering content. We were just going to find a new and creative way to do it. And thankfully, there was a grace period in which all of that learning took place. And I think maybe more than ever, the fact that we are able to provide content as well as conduct live Zoom meetings is giving people who otherwise have no access to to their peers that they're missing from these classes, they're able to connect now. So that apprehension that was there in the beginning is being replaced with the certainty that we are continuing to deliver on our mission and our promise to keep people connected. It's just in a different way.
Osher Lifelong Learning, that's something you pay for. It's not free. But this, because it's online, they're free, or they're, some of them are available?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, OLLI is a fee-based program. However, with this change sort of thrust upon us in the middle of a semester out of necessity, but also what a wonderful opportunity to sort of figure out as we go how to continue offer learning. And because it's on our website, give other people beyond our own program the chance to learn a little bit more about OLLI. Maybe they were working during the days when we offer most of our classes. Or, and I'll tell you, Mark, this is a really important point. We are able to reach people, and we're getting feedback from members who hadn't been members for a year or more, maybe because of transportation issues or mobility issues, who can now participate in OLLI again and be part of the conversation, whether it's watching recorded classes like Leanne's or Len's, or being part of the live meetings that we're offering too. So this is something that I think we'll continue to do as we're learning and figuring this out in the future.
That was Ann Nicoli, the program director of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. You can learn more about their classes online at olli.csuchico.edu. And that is your program. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.